This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The thing to do is to cut the ring off, guys. You know what I mean? Isolate them.
Okay, we'll do that.
Take them out one by one.
What about Randy, though? Right. Keep the eyes out.
Please leave Randy to me.
Hey, he's been doing a good job with Randy.
Come on, man. We're strategizing here, man. You okay?
Yeah, I'm listening to you guys.
You part of the family, too, man. You feel at home, right?
Yeah. Listen, we're all teammates, man. I can't lie to you guys. There's something that's been on my mind. I don't know how else to say it, but just to come out and say it.
Yeah, this is bothering you, man. Come on.
I don't know if you guys are aware of this or not, but...
Where what?
I'm different than you guys.
Oh, really?
It's obvious.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm the only one that's...
Hey, wait a minute. Hold on. Look. You with us, man. You're our boy. We got you, man.
All right. Look, all right. We all have one goal, and that's to win.
Yeah.
It's all about winning tonight, and that's the truth.
Good. All right, guys. It makes me feel better, you know, seeing that
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. Seeing that I am the only one that's...
That's what?
From ECW.
ECW.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what...
Yeah, what did you
think?
That's what
it's all about?
I got it.
Because...
You thought it meant because I'm Canadian.
That ain't got nothing to do with it, man. It doesn't matter where you're from, it's where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, we're all on the same page. Same team, you know? It's like, you know, you're a great rapper.
Yeah.
Just a little known fact that Canadians are also pretty good rappers.
You know? All right. Really? Spit some.
Did you hear that?
I've never heard that.
Spit some. Yeah, get your swag.
Well, I didn't let you hear anything. It's kind of out of the blue.
Yeah, just throw it out.
Just throw it out, man.
Get loose.
I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
Team Kofi Kingston looking for a fight. Four of us are black and one of us is white. What's up? What's up?
Hey everybody, welcome to another installment of the Survivor Series Rewind series here at Place to Be Nation. I'm Ben Morse from the Main Event as well as Marvel.com. I guess I can say that freely. There's no one here to stop me. I'm the editor of Marvel.com and it feels good to say. We are covering one of the most anticipated and highly regarded Survivor Series in really all of history. This is the one you guys have been waiting for. We're talking Survivor Series 2009 today, the seminal show that really put this pay-per-view on the map. And to do that, we need a panel of absolute studs, absolute experts. I got a lot of my cohorts from the Main Event and a wild card mixed in as well. So we'll have some good discussions today. We got a lot to talk about. Bring them in one by one. First of all, a guy I've only spoken to maybe once, and that would be the Count of Coolness from Connecticut. That is Glenn Butler, member of the High Spot, really great contributor to Place to Be Nation. Glenn, welcome.
Yes, thank you for that great introduction. And, of course, this show was anticipated for centuries.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of developments in human civilization were really building up to this, and frankly, it's been kind of downhill from there.
Yeah, right.
So, looking forward to talking about it.
When Nostradamus first talked about the Big Show, Undertaker, Chris Jericho triple threat match, and not a lot of people knew what he was talking about. You know,
people know that, but it's in the 45th tractate.
Yeah, you got it really deep. Good to have you, Glenn. And now my compatriots from the regular show, of course. First of all, we got the Second City Saint, the Chi-Town champion, your buddy from the High Spot, Glenn. And that is the conscience of P2B, Steve Willey. Steve, it's an honor.
It is an honor. Thank you for having me here. I'm very excited. Copernicus does say that the universe goes around the Big Show's giant head.
Absolutely. Science does not lie in that case. Rounding things out at the bottom of the order, the Motor City Madman, the Reverend of Rock and Roll, none other than the king of – what column do you write, Jordan? Never mind. I'm not going to put you on the spot there. Hey, everybody. It's Jordan Duncan.
I actually just learned how to write on a computer about a week ago. I didn't know all these buttons did anything.
Didn't you write about 24 one time?
Yeah, once.
That was it. That's all you needed. Twice.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Back in the old days of the territories and stuff, you know how wrestlers would have, like, totally different gimmicks from place to place? I think that this is kind of like that for us. We're only feuding on the main event. Here, we're just the best of pals.
Yeah, of course, of course. All the people who listen to the main event don't listen to this show, I'm assuming, so we're not breaking – we're not going to screw up our feud by acting cordial to one another.
Right, definitely not.
But, yeah, no, yeah, I feel like that 24 article was like your equivalent of that guy who writes a really successful jingle and then just makes millions off it and never has to do anything again.
Can you hear me now?
But, guys, as much as we're busting on it, 2009 Survivor Series is an interesting show. We were tasked with taking a late 2000s Survivor Series by the rest of the powers that be at Place to Be Nation, and we didn't really discuss it much. We kind of kicked a couple back and forth, and then I know when Justin and Brad and myself were ranking Survivor Series about a week and a half ago, I really wanted to do 2009 because it seemed it was one we had trouble placing because there are some good matches, there are some standout moments, but there's also it felt very inconsequential in the end, and that's a lot of what we're going to talk about today. I think a lot of how things could have come out of this, but didn't necessarily. 2009 was an interesting time for WWE. It was kind of a down period. I think they were doing fine financially, but really, I think they were just starting to get into the PG era. A lot of their stars were starting to age out and leave, and they were trying to build these new guys, and that's a lot what the show is about. Before we get to the show itself, and we're going to break it down match by match, and we're also going to discuss a lot of topics and a lot of guys, I want to get from each of you guys both your overall remembrance of where you were in 2009 as a fan, whether you saw this show, whether you watched it for the first time. I know there was some confusion from a lot of us as to whether we had seen this show before. But we'll start with Glenn. Do you remember watching the show before this week, Glenn Bowe?
Yes, I do. I did not remember it specifically when we first decided to do it, but when I looked it up and saw what the card was and which show it actually was, I did remember quite vividly, sort of vividly, watching it at a Buffalo Wild Wings in the middling city of Milford, Connecticut. And I had thought maybe I hadn't seen it because that year I stayed home for some of the pay-per-views to watch football, and which was a bad idea because 2009 was not the season to stay home and watch the New York Giants. But that turns out to have been bragging rights, and I do remember seeing Survivor Series.
Okay, so you skipped bragging rights, but you did watch Survivor Series.
Indeed.
Steve, where were you at in 2009 as far as being a fan? Were you still into the product, or was that a period where maybe you were half paying attention?
Yeah, this was a period I was half paying attention. Mm-hmm. I remember being a little bit into Ring of Honor at this time. And just if I was available Monday night, I might have caught Raw. Really, in terms of feuds that were going on, I was only aware of one that we'll talk about towards the middle of the show.
Got it. Finally, you, JD, what was going on with Jordan Duncan in the year 2009? You know, you were just finishing your ministry work. You were, you know, full of hope, thought you could change the world. What's happening?
Well, actually, it was actually I was really into the Ministry of Darkness at that point. Oh, wait, that was 1999. I'm sorry. Let's fast forward 10 years. No, I was a lot like Steve. Very definition of a casual fan at that point. I mean, I kind of still paid attention, and most of my paying attention was just from keeping up with friends online who watch wrestling. I probably watched Raw most weeks, but I doubt that I checked in for SmackDown, and certainly not for ECW. And I'm guessing the feud that Steve was mentioning is also the same one for me, because I was definitely aware of it, but even as we were talking before we went on the air, I was mixing some of the stuff that happened on Raw up with what I thought happened here. Definitely did not pay for this pay-per-view. I was checked out of buying pay-per-views by then. I was maybe waiting for DVDs or things like that. So didn't see it when it happened, but I do think that I may have seen it before.
Yeah, I think what I did with this one was by the time 2009 came around, like I've never stopped watching wrestling since I started as a kid, but there's definitely been periods that where, like you guys said, you know, you become a casual fan,
you maybe check in once in a while more out of habit than anything else. And also in 2009, the big thing for me was I wasn't friends with anyone who was watching wrestling. So there was no impetus. Once a lot of the guys I work with started watching and switched jobs, that kind of got me going again. And that was more towards 2011, 2012. But 2009, I remember what I was doing was I had 24/7. And instead of watching pay-per-views live, I would just watch them when they were on 24/7 a couple months later. That was basically my pay-per-view method from about 2006 to 2010, at the very least. So
yeah, I was definitely out of getting monthly pay-per-views for probably a couple of years by this point.
Right.
Outside of, you know, WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, I always got. And most of the SummerSlams I got. I don't think I got SummerSlam 2009, though, which was that Punk and Jeff Hardy?
It was, Punk and Jeff Hardy finished the show.
Did not get that one.
Yeah, it was an interesting, like I said, it was an interesting time for WWE. They had just kind of gone back to John Cena. Interestingly enough, John Cena and Randy Orton feuded for most of the fall of 2009. That was 5 years ago. But they were trying a couple different things. And I want to jump right into the first match here, which was a 5-on-5 Survivor Series elimination match. And it was Team Miz against Team Morrison. So he had on one side The Miz, who was the U.S. champ and was on Raw. He had with him Drew McIntyre, Sheamus, Dolph Ziggler, and Jack Swagger against John Morrison, who at this point was babyface Intercontinental Champion on SmackDown. He has with him Matt Hardy, Evan Bourne, Shelton Benjamin, and Finlay. So it's a very interesting cast of guys who are still around now, guys who you were kind of a flash in the pan, guys who are coming to the end of their run. They go 20 minutes. Looking at the eliminations really quick, Dolph Ziggler gets eliminated first. Gets eliminated 4 minutes into the match by Evan Bourne. Drew McIntyre takes out a few guys. He takes out both Evan and later Matt Hardy. Sheamus, who they were really building as a monster here, who had just come from ECW Raw, he takes out Finlay at about the five-minute mark. Then you go for a little while, and then Morrison starts showing off. Morrison gets Swagger out. Miz gets Shelton Benjamin out. Shelton been kind of a non-factor in the match. Mm-hmm. And things finish off with Sheamus eliminating Morrison with the high cross. So really, the survivors here, Miz, Sheamus, and Drew, and Sheamus really pushed as the monster. Miz starting to look like a star. I want to go around once before we talk about specific stuff to get impressions on the match itself. Jordan, what did you think when you were watching this? Hot opener, forgettable match? What was your opinion?
No, I liked it. And as they were coming out, I really thought to myself, wow, I really like Team Morrison.
Yeah.
I like everybody on that team. And Finlay kind of stuck out there because it was kind of like, not that Matt Hardy's a high flyer, but he could pass for one, you know?
Sure.
And then Finlay comes out. I'm like, well, that one doesn't seem to fit, but I'm not going to complain about having Finlay out there. I really liked that team, and I liked the match. Had a lot of flow to it, and this is where I may have seen the show, but I definitely don't remember what happened. So seeing Sheamus just kind of bulldoze over everybody was kind of cool to see, and he looked pretty good. I remember, if I remember right, the next month was when he won the title from Cena, right?
Yeah. This is a month before he wins his first WWE title.
And I remember a lot of people were really down on him, and I remember not liking him at the time. But watching this match, I don't see why I didn't like him. Maybe he was just protected really well, but I thought Sheamus really looked like a star in this one, and I thought it was a good opener. I really liked it.
It's funny because as much as I wasn't really watching Raw, or even if I was watching Raw but not paying attention, ECW in 2009 was like appointment TV for me for some reason.
yeah, for sure.
It's funny you say that, Ben. Like now that we talked about that, I remember the ECW watching ECW, and maybe it was just the day that it was on.
It was just, you know what, I think part of it was the day it was on, but I remember like the few other buddies I had who watched wrestling were just so refreshed by ECW because at this point in 2009, it was far removed from being connected to ECW by anything but name. It really was more kind of like what NXT is today.
Yep, that's what I was just thinking.
It was the step beyond the developmental territory. So Sheamus, when he debuted in ECW, I remember he had a feud there with Goldust. I don't know if you guys remember that. And it was tremendous. Like, Sheamus and Goldust were out there having great matches. Guys like, you know, Zack Ryder, Evan Bourne, all these guys who, you know, would go on to do nothing on the quote-unquote main roster, because at that point ECW really was NXT. But, that was looking back on this show, it made me remember how much I loved watching ECW at the time. So, very interesting that Sheamus stands out to you. Steve, what were your thoughts on just the match itself?
I really enjoyed it. It was a nice lead to the Survivor Series, and I'm always a fan of leading with a traditional Survivor Series matchup. I loved the face team as well. What stood out to me right away is not one guy on that face side is still active in the WWE.
Right.
Which is, you know, you just had said that, you know, we're here we are with Orton and Cena again 5 years later. Every single one of them is gone. Most of them still active wrestling, but just not around there.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the face team, they're pretty much, they're all active to some degree. I think Sheldon's over in Japan, and I mean, I guess Finlay is with WWE technically, he's a trainer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bourne just went back to Ring of Honor and is in Japan as well, and Shelton Japan.
Morrison Lucha Underground.
Yeah, Morrison. Yep.
Yeah, I want to talk about a couple of those guys at length in a sec, but first I just want to get Glenn's thoughts on the match.
I thought it was a really fun match. I thought it avoided one of the pitfalls of the Survivor Series match, I think is kind of a bugbear for all of us, which is guys getting pinned by transitional moves or moves that in like a one-on-one match or a tag match would never end the match. Sure. But in Survivor Series, you got to keep it moving. They had a lot of guys hitting their finishers and doing it pretty solidly. You mentioned Ziggler gets put out pretty early, but he has a really good segment with Evan Bourne ending with the shooting star press.
Yeah.
You know, Morrison even gets to hit Starship Pain in one of the very few times that he actually hit it.
Yeah.
Usually he's out of position or the other guy's out of position and it's just horrible. It was a really good one here. Sheamus got to hit a couple different finishers. So it was varied and it was all their finishers, which is a real highlight.
It's true. No one was eliminated by anything but a finisher in this match.
Toward the beginning of this match, we had something that's kind of a highlight for me, which is when Michael Cole lists off countries where the pay-per-view is being seen. Right. I transcribed the one he did in this match. He said the show is being watched in places like the United Kingdom on Sky Box Office, all over Mexico tonight, Switzerland, the Philippines, and in many countries throughout the entire Middle East. Oh, I wish I could go see a pay-per-view all over Mexico tonight. Yeah. Wouldn't that be great?
I would love to know what kind of venues as well people are watching these pay-per-views at various countries in the Middle East and all over Mexico. I'm sure it was not a Buffalo Wild Wings.
Well, all over the Middle East, that might be the military network, right?
That's what I'm assuming.
The Bahrain Wild Wings.
Yeah.
I was really impressed that it was all over Mexico, not just like parts of Mexico.
No, yeah.
All over
Mexico, and there are some remote regions, so that's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Right, there wasn't a part of Mexico that was untouched. Yeah, yeah, but I'm glad you transcribed that, Glenn, because I think points like that are what's going to really put this episode of the Survivor Series Rewind over the top, is our unique fun facts, like knowing that this aired all over Mexico. But what I want to talk about specifically this match, I agree with you guys. I thought it was a pretty cool opener. It's 20 minutes, which obviously most Survivor Series elimination matches go long, but didn't feel that way. Great array of performers, great array of moves, never slowed down. I want to talk about the guys in this match who are either no longer with WWE or who are still with WWE but seem to be kind of stalled out. Because to me, what's interesting is really the guys from this who made it were Sheamus and, of all people, Ziggler, who, like I said, Ziggler's gone 4 minutes into the match and looked completely different in this match. You know, he still had the vest, was doing all that different stuff. For me, the guys who caught my attention most here were Morrison, who it seemed like they always wanted to break him out as a babyface and he never quite got there, but he was very over here and he performed very well. And knowing what he's doing now with Lucha Underground, I guess this is kind of echoing something Scott Keats says all the time. I can't believe they haven't tried to bring him back and really push him on top. Evan Bourne seemed to me like a can't miss prospect from here, and I know he had some other issues. You know, with failing drug tests, with stuff like that. But just, again, seemed like the type of guy who you go out of your way to try to help because just had a style that no one else could replicate. But honestly, for me, the big one here is that there was something about Drew McIntyre.
Yep.
He wasn't there. And I think this was part of the problem with Drew McIntyre and how they treated him was they pushed him so hard, so fast. And you could tell in this match that He does not quite have the tools to be a top-level guy, but man, the potential was there. And watching him in this match, just his presence, just little things like when he walks to the ring and the aggressiveness and the facial expressions, it made me really look back on his release a couple months ago and really the way he spent the last couple years of his WWE run as being such a waste. And looking at the 10 guys in this match, I think at least 4 or 5 should be stars. As it is, only 4 of them are still in WWE and 2 of them are pretty inconsequential. So I want to go back around the horn and kind of get a take on that. Who from this match could have been a bigger deal, and just thoughts on the individual players. We'll switch it up, and Steve, start with you.
Well, to build off what you said about Drew McIntyre, he's been making the rounds lately on different shows, and he's only 27 years old right now.
That's insane.
Yeah, he's been with the WWE. He was with the WWE for, I want to say, 6 years or so. So he was only 22 around here. So, of course, he's, you know, still really young and hasn't, you know, found the, you know, the in-ring part of his career yet. Because he was, from what I was hearing about him, is that he was pretty much in matches very quick into his career, like within a couple weeks in Europe. Then was signed very quickly into WWE, I want to say within like 19 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that this time is that they pushed these guys so young that after a while they don't know what to do with them and they're not ready for it. So when they don't, you know, succeed beyond their wild, their wildest expectations, like a guy maybe say like Randy Orton, who, you know, had it in his blood, they just shove him back down. And, you know, at that point, there's very few guys who could handle that and move back up. And I think Drew will be back at some point.
Yeah. JD, talk to me a little bit more about the babyface team. I know you said you liked them so much and you thought there could be something to do with it. Was there anyone from this babyface team who, is there something different they could have done that one of them at least should still be with WWE in some capacity?
Well, I tend to give WWE a pass on the Evan mm-hmm. Bourne thing.
Sure.
You know, I think they could have put more faith in him, but I totally understand why they didn't. You know, totally not their fault, although I do think he could have been maybe the next Rey Mysterio for them in that capacity. But I think Morrison's the obvious one that they missed on. And, you know, rumors, who knows how much we really know, but a lot of it was Morrison leaving on his own accord. But the fact that he hasn't been back since, it really strikes me that it means they haven't reached out to him. Because, like you said, he was big here. And what's funny to me about Morrison, that I always, just the impression I always got, he's a little sloppy.
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if that's why they held back on pulling the trigger on him. But if the fans are really into somebody, who cares if they're sloppy? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's Jeff Hardy was way more sloppy than John Morrison was, and he was way more popular, you know? So I think Morrison's probably the biggest miss on the face side. You know, Finley, by the time they got him, the fact that he was still wrestling at such a high level is pretty remarkable to compare that to Drew McIntyre, who's 22. Finley was probably twice that age, probably in his 40s at least by then.
Oh, yeah.
Shelton had been around for a while. Matt Hardy had been around for a while. I think Morrison's really the one that could have gone on to bigger and better things from this point forward. And even having him be the guy that goes down 3-1, I thought it was interesting that he didn't at least get to beat Miz.
Yeah.
You know, I could see the idea of having Sheamus be the muscle that takes him out, but I'm surprised they didn't at least give him the pin over Miz there and then have Sheamus just come in and bulldoze him.
I will say this before we move on to Glenn for a sec. I did want to talk about Miz briefly because as much as we bag on Miz these days, and he did kind of, you know, he had his run at the top and then he kind of got stale. I absolutely, just when he came out here, his intro, his swagger, everything, I get why he was WWE champion a year later. I think WWE would have been dropping the ball not to. But it's kind of...
I totally agree.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting discussion, though, of, I think, you know, granted, we're covering Survivor Series 2009, but if we jumped a year ahead, it's crazy to me that they never ran Miz Morrison as a WWE title feud.
Yeah.
Well, they had a title match.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was a really good one on the New Year's Raw in 2011 when Miz was having...
That was on Raw.
Yeah, when Miz was having just – he had good matches with a whole lot of people in 2011 that he didn't get enough credit for. But going back here, I think there's a good reason to not have Morrison give him the pin here, and that's because even from here, the push is on.
Yeah.
And Miz is rolling so well as U.S. champion that they had to give him Money in the Bank, which was just something else for him to crow about, and then ultimately the title. It was growing from this point, so I think – they recognized that, and that's why they didn't really want to beat Miz here.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I think Miz definitely had to come out of this looking good. And the other problem was they were on – this was when the brand split was still in effect, and they weren't going to feud.
Yeah. I also think, too, part of why he didn't win is also what we're going to see later in the night. You know, that might take away from another guy who got a pretty big win there. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, JD, when you're going back to you're talking about guys like Shelton, Shelton Benjamin's incredibly talented, but at this point, he was what? He was 2009. He was about 6-7 years into his tenure. It's like they had kind of done everything they could with him.
Basically, when Shelton Benjamin entered his gold period, it's pretty forgettable to me.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think it was a good opener. It kind of showcases something we'll talk more about in a couple matches in terms of some missed opportunities, but as we just kind of covered, some like maybe they weren't missed opportunities. Maybe it just wasn't meant to be. We'll see. The second match is, I think, one of the matches that people do remember this show for, or at the very least, one of the feuds people remember for.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah.
Can I interrupt you, though?
Oh, of course.
Before we got the second match, we had a pretty fun backstage segment.
Oh, I did not recap backstage. So you please tell me.
Oh, yeah. We had a backstage segment with Christian and his teammates, which was Kofi Kingston, Mark Henry. Who else was it? R-Truth
and MVP.
Yeah, and Christian was very nervous because he realized he was different from his teammates. And it was a very obvious joke, but Christian actually made it work. You know, because he was the only guy from ECW. Then he mentioned he's Canadian, and then he busted out into a rap, and it was a pretty fun little segment. It's always nice when WWE actually does comedy that's like, oh, that was funny, you know?
If it had been anyone but Christian, I think it would have been tough. But no, I agree. I think we were talking right before we came on the air. The thing when he does the rap basically says four of them are black and one of them are white.
Yeah.
And the range of reactions from the different guys on his team was part of what sold it for me, because it's like Kofi's really incapable of looking like a, for lack of a better term, scary black guy. But but MVP looked like he wanted to kill Christian, which was great. But yeah, I like that segment a lot. To this day, it made me laugh again when I watched it the other day. So thank you. If there are any other backstage segments, please bring those back up, JD. I'm putting you officially in charge of those.
I sure will.
It's a lot of responsibility. I know you can handle it. But as I was saying, Batista and Rey Mysterio, they did have a great video package building up to this match. Basically, Batista had turned heel for the first time in about 4 or 5 years. Gotten frustrated with Mysterio because Mysterio somewhat stopped him from winning the world title the month before at Bragging Rights. Turned on Mysterio. Beat the crap out of him. It was that great Batista heel turn moment that I think we all remember, where he just calmly told Rey. Like, it was weird enough because they had an interview after a Fatal 4-Way match, an in-ring interview, and it's Mysterio being like, we'll get him next time, Dave, and Batista just going, I don't remember the exact line, but basically he said he was going to kill Rey.
Yeah.
He was very obvious about it. I mean, any court would convict him. but he basically said, like, I just want to destroy you. Beat Rey horribly. They went back and forth for a few weeks, Rey trying to make amends, but Batista making it clear he wasn't having it. So they have their first big singles match here. And it's a brutal, fun match. It goes six minutes and 50 seconds. Batista hits the Batista bomb on Rey 3 times, and then the referee stops the match. So different kind of finish, and really started pushing heel Batista strong. Glenn, thoughts on the match? What did you think?
I thought the match was just tremendous. I thought Batista's heel turn was tremendous. There are four main reasons why his turn came off so well, I think. One, it's just what he's naturally gifted at as a performer, I think. Two, Rey is such a good babyface that turning someone against him is just a natural thing to do. And it's a crutch that they use many times, but Rey is just so good. They had been friends at least since he got to SmackDown in 2005. So there was all the background there. They were tag champions. They had that feud with Eminem. They had that feud with Big Show and Kane, I think, when Batista got injured. They had a lot of background there. And because Batista was a face for years before this, so it actually meant something when he turned. And it's kind of interesting to think now that this heel turn and the run that he put on until the spring of 2010, I think, when he left, mm-hmm. was so good that it was totally irresistible after he came back in 2014. Right. They just they couldn't unring that bell from years ago.
Sure, it's funny. It's funny given how much time he spent as a babyface, how much we remember his heel run. It was that impactful, and he was that good at it.
Yeah, totally. Plus, turning because Ray cost him the title reinforces the importance of being champion, absolutely. Which is something that I know a lot of people bang on sometimes.
Yeah.
The only part that might not work so well in terms of Batista's heel turn is that this pay-per-view is in Washington.
Right. So I was
in which next. Is kind of an unfortunate circumstance that happens sometimes. But I think even despite that, the everything else that's going into the heel turn really makes it come off well. He just beats the crap out of him.
Well, let me
you can look at
No, go ahead.
I was just gonna say you can look at the time and say that it didn't go all that long, mm-hmm. but it was pretty vicious for the amount of time that it was there. Plus more after the match.
Yep.
As well.
Yep. It goes for a few minutes after, and I do want to flip it there because that was one of the things I want to talk about was the crowd, and I'll flip it over to JD. Jordan, do you think they made a mistake having this match in DC, which is Batista's hometown? Should they have held off a month? Should they have, you know, done an injury angle with Ray or something? Or does the fact that the crowd is so rabid, even if they happen to be, you know, behind the heel, does that actually add to the quality of the match?
Well, I think it added to it. And what's interesting about it is if you watch the story, this is what I think makes for the best heel. Batista was, in a way, right and justified in how he felt.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, I mean, Ray really did screw him over, you know, and I think that's why maybe fans were cheering, because it is odd to see a crowd turn on Ray Mysterio.
Oh, yeah.
That and the Rumble, 2014 Rumble, and
yeah,
that's, the there's not very many, there's not very many options. You know, usually Ray draws that sympathy, even in a situation like that. So I don't think they were wrong for doing it there, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, Ray's going to get that great babyface sympathy. And even, too, in his few little hope spots that he got, the crowd was into him. They weren't booing him when he was on the offense or anything like that. I think Batista was just so awesome and so brutal that you can't help but get into it. You know, I think they were chanting one more time after he hit him with, like, the third Batista bomb. The crowd wants another one, you know. So, I think it was fine that they did it there. And, you know, the crowd response, this – speaks a lot to the booking then compared to maybe now, is they didn't panic based on that response, say, oh, the crowd likes him. You know, they just stayed the course. And like you guys talked about, that short, what was it, 6 months of heel Batista is what we remember more than 4 to 5 years of babyface Batista. You know, and I'm glad they stayed with it, because it was the start of really a fantastic run for him. So, yeah, I think it's fine that they did it here.
It's a good point on not panicking. And actually, I'll throw that one to Steve. Steve, is anyone better at playing this particular role than Rey Mysterio? Like, if you want to bring up guys like, you know, Ricky Morton, X-Pac, whoever, but is anyone better at just playing the, okay, we need to get a new heel over, so just beat the crap out of Rey role?
Boy, you know, you go back to NWO when he was throwing like a lawn dart into the trailer by Nash. You know, kind of really disgusting spot he had with the Big Show when he was strapped to the stretcher and thrown into the post. But he did it, you know, in the video package. It was so cool. Like, when Batista turned on him, grabbed him by the throat, and Ray was just saying, please, Dave, take it easy. I beg you. Like, mm-hmm. just kind of begging it off. And not, you know, looking for sympathy, not like, you know, being cowardly, just looking for to work things out with him.
Yeah.
The one thing that I found odd about this match is the contract signings that Batista had to sign off that he wasn't going to be held liable for what he did for Ray. Does that mean, like, in other matches, the loser can sue?
I think the implication there, to go a little bit kayfabe, was that he was going to do things to Ray that were so far beyond the boundaries of a normal wrestling match that he did not want Ray to sue him for those things that he was going to do.
It was
above and beyond violence. Like he was,
backseat of a Volkswagen type stuff.
Yeah, like really uncomfortable. Stuff that would make people really uncomfortable. But it's one of those things where they tack on the same way as, you know, where they'll do an unsanctioned street fight and then the referee will DQ somebody. Sure. It's one of those things that just makes it sound better. But yeah, it was a memorable match. Honestly, the thing I remember most about this was beyond the match itself was that I thought Batista should have, you know, become champion right away out of this. And then I remember it took him a few months and a jump to Raw to do so. But great feud.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Great old school feud. Very, very old school in the sense that, you know, you had the friend turning on the other friend because he cost him the championship, which is how it used to be. Any other thoughts on this one before we move on to another elimination match, guys?
Yeah, I bet there was weeping all over Mexico that
night. Oh, yeah.
One of the things that I liked during one of the small segments when Ray was actually doing okay was he gave Batista a 619 to the back and then another one to the gut before he was able to get him down for the proper 619. I just thought that was a really nice touch as far as the construction of the match.
Right. I mean, it's always hard when you have someone's Ray's size going up against someone Batista's size because it's hard to believe that the match would last any longer than a few minutes. And actually, Ray went on a nice run here because I know he had matches with The Undertaker a few months after this.
Oh, his match with The Undertaker at the Rumble was great.
Yeah, and it's 2 months after this, and he was really at the height of his powers of making you believe he could hang with these guys, even if it is only for 6 minutes. Like you said, I think his hope segments here feel longer because you don't expect him to get any at all. But yeah, it makes me wish that they had somehow kept this feud going or they had a way to push Batista further, but you know, I think they did get their mileage out of this because Ray did get a good babyface run, challenging for the title, and Batista became a real legit heel. Unfortunately, about a year later, they were both either gone or injured. So it plays again into our theme here of planning for the future or not so much. And before we get into the kind of the definition of the planning for the future, JD, were there any backstage segments?
I'm pretty sure there was a segment with Randy Orton and his team, and he was not happy with them.
Yeah.
Just kind of dressing them down a little bit, and CM Punk kind of stood out as the one who didn't take his crap.
That was kind of cool, yeah, because you had Randy with Regal, the two legacy guys, DiBiase and Rhodes, and Punk. And I like how Orton, he dresses him down, says, you know, he was expecting to have the ECW champion in Regal and the tag champs in Rhodes and DiBiase and the world champ in Punk, but he's got nobody. And then they all just kind of kowtow to him until Punk steps up and says, you know, well, you're not the WWE champ either. And they decide to go out and make most of it. But yeah, it was definitely a classic heel team that all hate each other, but they're working towards a common purpose. But yeah, you know, it's a good point, JD, that they were at this point. Punk had such a hot summer of 2009, first heel turn in WWE, feuding with Jeff Hardy, definitely was a hot character here. So it was cool that they gave him that moment to stand out before they went into the match, and it was not necessarily about him.
Yeah. I think it completely fits his character, like to a T.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been very out of character for him to sit there and take it.
Right, someone who, like, you know, Orton wasn't an authority or anything, but he was definitely the alpha male.
Yep.
And Punk, you know, behind the scenes and on camera, not going to take that kind of stuff.
Right.
Not one to miss an opportunity to mouth off. No.
Yes.
Yeah. And you can read more of that mouthing off come February 2015 in Thor Annual Number 1, where Sam will be writing a backup story, and we're all really excited about it, everyone on this show. So moving into the match, this was kind of cool. This was promoted as there are two main events on the show. I would say this is kind of the third main event. I think in the opening video package, it got a lot of play. And that's Randy Orton's team, who we just discussed, taking on Team Kingston, which, as someone said, I forget where I read it the other day, but the idea that there would be a Team Kofi Kingston 5 short years later is kind of a crazy notion. But this match is one of the reasons why it seems like maybe it wasn't so crazy. Anyways, you got Kofi, MVP, Mark Henry, R-Truth, and Christian, as we mentioned. They did a great skit earlier. And this stemmed out of Orton. Basically, Kofi was feuding with Legacy. in the sense that him and Cody actually had an issue stemming out of bragging rights because Kofi accidentally cost Cody a pinfall. And then later in the night, when Cody and DiBiase were trying to help Orton defend the WWE title against Cena, Kofi would come out and get rid of Legacy. And so suddenly Orton blames Kofi Kingston for him not being WWE champion. They had a great lead up to this match here where Kofi, who had dropped the Jamaican accent just a couple months earlier and was finally starting to be taken a little seriously, he ruined Randy's new car. You guys remember that? Where he dumped
yeah.
the paint
all over yeah.
his car? I feel like that's like one of the two defining Kofi Kingston moments. And then not long after what Jordan was talking about earlier at the Madison Square Garden Raw just before the show, he does a boom drop on Orton from out of the stands, puts him through a table, and MSG was just going crazy for Kofi Kingston. Probably the most over Kofi's ever been in his career. Would anyone disagree with that?
Oh, no way. Yeah.
Definitely not.
This was
so big for a babyface to get that kind of pop at Madison Square Garden, too. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way this match goes, it really is a showcase for Kofi, because the way the eliminations go, Mark Henry, R-Truth, both eliminated really quickly by Orton and Punk. DiBiase goes courtesy of Christian. Regal goes courtesy of MVP. And Cody takes out MVP. And then I remember the long stretch of it being basically Christian and Kofi hanging in there against Orton, Punk, and Cody. Christian gets Cody out of there. Orton gets Christian out of there. And that sets up kind of the final. It was a long segment. It went a good 7 minutes of it just being Kofi 2-on-1 against Punk and Orton. And really great storytelling in this one. Orton actually was doing really good character.
Yeah.
He was just stalking outside the ring, trying to get Punk to do the work.
Oh, I love that. He wasn't even on the apron.
Right.
It was almost like, if you want to face me, you've got to beat him first.
Like Punk became basically the King Hippo.
It turns into
Mike Tyson.
Right. It turns into a gauntlet match, essentially, you know?
Yeah, and the great thing is the end, when it comes, it's Kofi rolls up Punk, and then 8 seconds later hits a Trouble in Paradise on Orton. And so Kofi's the sole survivor. Kofi insanely over. Let's break it down in terms of the match, and also, again, just in terms of we'll devote a whole bit to how over Kofi was, but let's talk about the match and some of the other performers. Steve, why don't you kick us off?
At the beginning of the match, I really liked the heel team working together and strategizing, especially since we saw them backstage fighting a little bit. They would jump down off of the – I think it was right away after they had the first elimination. They jumped out of the ring, regrouped on the floor, huddled up, and looked like they were planning. And there's something now about seeing Punk and Regal side by side, which was really cool for me.
Yeah, it felt like they were into it too.
Yeah, it just looked like they were having a lot of fun being on the same side together. I was surprised at some of the quick eliminations that we saw.
Sure.
And we did see one later on. I think it was Christian on DiBiase, where he basically won with a sunset flip off the second rope.
Yeah.
Which is what Glenn alluded to earlier. We didn't see in the first match. It was like a transition move. That was a surprise for me. And who did he eliminate with the Unprettier? Was that Cody?
He gets Cody with the Unprettier. So, yeah, Christian gets both the Legacy guys.
He had a note that looked like that really hurt when Rhodes landed on his – pretty much took it on his head.
Also of note, Cole calls about three different moves the kill switch in this
match. Right.
Like there's a reverse DDT is a kill switch. Probably the sunset flip was a kill switch. Like it's clear Christian has been on ECW for some time, and Michael Cole thinks his arsenal solely consists of kill switches.
Where do you guys think – I had this kind of note down there because we were talking before we went on there about you know, really liking Christian. Did you think that he might be Hall of Fame worthy for the WWE? Like where do you guys think he ranks kind of all time?
I think for sure he'll go in eventually. They tend to put in guys who are, you know, stalwarts for them. And I think – the run he had with the world title in 2011 cemented that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think he deserves it. I mean, there's two types of Hall of Fame inductees. There's guys who, you know, are they going to go in? Yeah, they'll probably go in at some point. But there's also, did they deserve it? Yeah, Christian absolutely deserves it. I mean, Attitude Era work with Edge, coupled with his world title run, and then everything in between, just like the early 2000s when, you know, the show was really dragging and he was carrying the mid card. And
there was all that, but there was also around this time in 2009, early 2010 in ECW, he really made that show.
Oh, yeah.
He was the veteran presence on top and just having good matches with everybody. I mean, he had great title defenses with Yoshitatsu, with Zack Ryder, with Goldust. I don't remember if he ever fought Finley or if I just really wanted him to.
He even had some great matches with Tommy Dreamer, I think, towards the end of the ECW run.
Yeah.
Tommy Dreamer was on his last legs at that point.
That's true. Tommy was physically deteriorated. Tommy can still tell a story better than 90% of the guys. But no, absolutely. I mean, Christian was John Cena in 2009 ECW. It's another reason why I loved ECW. It was great. But no, I think Christian absolutely belongs in the Hall of Fame.
And an actually goofy sense of humor as opposed to a faux goofy sense of humor like Cena has.
Right. Christian is legitimately funny.
I think the only thing I would say against him is he's not going to be that headline main event induction ever.
No, certainly not.
But yeah, he's definitely worthy. I mean, just not that that's really a factor, but match quality alone, man, he's had so many really good matches.
Absolutely.
Now Glenn's got me wondering about a Finley match. That would be a lot of fun to watch, I bet, but I don't really remember one either.
Well, I'm sure that someone will tell us exactly the date it occurred of after they listen to this podcast.
Well, I do remember toward the end of ECW, they did turn Finley heel for about 2 weeks.
Yep, I know what you're talking about.
Which was...
It may have been just to go after the title, actually, so I think that there was probably a likelihood. Christian wrestled everyone on the ECW roster in 2009.
Yeah.
And so they were always 12-minute matches, too, you know?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. That show was really solid. It was what SmackDown was in 2006-7.
Yeah, I wish they'd add it to the network. It's just another reason why. Now, you know what? I don't want to get into it, but I should be able to watch WWE's ECW on the WWE network.
It'll all come eventually. Just keep resubscribing.
And keep Hope alive.
Yeah, definitely keep Hope alive. All right, so let's talk about some of the other guys in this match. You know what? Another guy I actually want to talk about, because I think he stood out a little. Not even so much that he stood out in this match, but just in terms of star presence at a time when they needed it and someone who could have been someone moving forward. I'm going to bring up MVP, because I don't think they ever put the push behind babyface MVP that they should have. I think they moved him to Raw right after his face turn. He was over. I remember he got in Randy Orton's face. He had that brief run. Then he lost the U.S. title, and then he dropped into the tag team with Mark Henry, and he never quite recovered. But as far as a guy who had good matches, good charisma, could actually be something, and is one of the bright spots now in TNA. And I know he wanted to go to Japan and he wanted to do all this other stuff, but to me, he's almost like a sub John Morrison level guy in terms of maybe they could have done more with this guy. And I feel like he was in a tough spot on Raw because there were enough guys above him in the pecking order. But JD, what are your thoughts on MVP, both on this match and this period?
Well, I can't speak a lot on that time period because it's a little fuzzy for me, but
based on what you saw here.
Yeah. I think he looked like a star. I mean, he has the ball and elbow, and the crowd shouts it, and it's a loud response. And
that's exactly what I was thinking of, yeah.
You know, and some people might say, well, that's cheap, but who cares?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, if cheap works, then that's what you do. I liked his moveset. One thing I always struggle with MVP was I never really dug his finisher. I wish he would just do the kick as a finisher, which I think he used the kick as a win.
Right.
He eliminated somebody with it.
Yeah,
he
eliminates Regal with the kick here.
Okay. So Regal and Finley both get kicked in the face to lose their matches. You know, but I think if he would have switched that up, maybe, not to say that a finisher is what held him back, but I think he never had that one impact move, maybe. But like you said, I think it's more that they never really got behind him as a babyface like they did as a heel. Because I do remember him as a heel on SmackDown coming in and all kinds of stuff like that. But his face run, I just kind of remember being buddies with Mark Henry, and that's really about all I remember, to be honest.
Yeah, so. It just stood out to me as, you know, kind of the theme of this show of guys who could have done more. I think MVP, as a babyface specifically, could have done more.
Mm-hmm.
But the poster boy for really this whole pay-per-view, as far as missed opportunities, got to be Kofi Kingston. Steve, talk to me a little bit about Kofi's performance in this match, whether it lived up to the hype they gave him going in, and then we'll talk about what happened to him coming out of it.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I was only aware of one thing going on at this time, and that was Randy Orton and Kofi Kingston. I actually sought that out when after the Madison Square Garden incident, and I thought it was incredible that he got so over, like I said, with the Madison Square Garden crowd, because he's generally a, you know, all throughout his career, just kind of a mid-card, happy, slap hands with the crowd face. He wasn't in too much in the match. Once he squared off with Punk, you know, just the stare down they had, and I didn't realize they had a brief history as a tag team. I do know that they've been were traveling partners for a long
right.
time.
He was his road wife.
Yes.
That's what Punk called him. He said, Kofi is my road wife.
And so right away when the two of them squared off, they had the stare off, and Kofi did look a little angry, and they had that great 7-minute sketch. As you said, the two of them just going at it. And then after the quick flash kick and pin on Orton, he was over. I mean, the crowd was, you know, not just into him at Madison Square Garden, but in Washington, too. I don't think it was that they were that behind him at the beginning, but towards the end when he put them both out, he was made right there. I'm excited to hear what happened next, because I purposely did not look at it in advance of this podcast, because I wanted to just kind of hear. I know that he went downhill, but great sell by Orton, too, of the Trouble in Paradise.
Yeah.
So Orton was really working hard to put him over. Orton gets a lot of crap, I think, but here he did great.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting segue into what happened to Kofi. Because basically, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, gossip, and we don't totally know what happened. What happened was Kofi went into a main event level feud with Randy Orton and then lost to him in a decent match the next month at TLC. But it wasn't a he's buried, he's done, he can never come back from this loss. Would he have probably done better if Orton had put him over? Maybe. But basically the rumor at the time and then going into the winter was that Orton is the guy who buried Kofi, as far as saying he was a sloppy worker. I think he hurt him once, and he didn't think he was ready for the main event. And for whatever reason, once 2010 rolled around, Kofi would hang around the main event level of Raw, kind of on the periphery for a little while longer. But then when the next draft came around, he got shoved over to SmackDown and kind of became the Kofi we know today, kind of the mid-card smiling babyface who's always contending for secondary titles and never quite got back to the main event. So if everything's to be believed, it's a combination of the fact that Kofi botched a few moves, Randy Orton got mad at him, and then no one stood up for him. But at the end of the day, a guy who was this over in this match and seemed to be on the rise, should WWE just kind of say, like, you know what, fuck you, Randy Orton, you're working with this guy, you're putting him over, or I don't know. I want to get a – before we kind of take a halftime here, let's go around the circle and say, based on not only this, but what we've seen of Kofi in the past 5 years, is he a guy who could have been a main event level guy given a chance, or would he eventually have imploded on his own? Glenn, what do you think?
I think that if they really put a push behind someone and they're really determined to make something happen, then they can make it happen. And kind of dashing Kofi on the rocky shores of a Randy Orton feud isn't the best way to get that started. You can actually think of three times when there were guys kind of on their way up and they ran into a feud with Orton. The first one that I can really remember was at Unforgiven 2006. He fought Carlito. Mm. And I believe Carlito had recently turned face.
Yeah.
That was during the angle with Trish Stratus, I think.
Right.
And Carlito were together.
I always forget that Carlito, like, yeah, he had a romance with Trish Stratus.
Yeah, it's strange to think about now, but he had this match with Orton that I remember at the time kind of wanting him to win, because I was never any fan of Orton until after this. But that obviously did not go well for Carlito, and he kind of fizzled out for a while and was eventually gone. Kofi here, after this, kind of fizzled out a little. Like you say, he's always a solid person to get the Intercontinental title for a little while to lose to someone they want to get it, or the U.S. title, or even the tag titles. But never really after this scene as a guy who could maybe step through that gateway. The only one who had a feud with Orton as kind of a test and kind of a step up and really made it eventually was Jeff Hardy. And even that took a circuitous route after the whole Orton feud. So it's kind of difficult to see Orton as that kind of gateway for someone. I don't know if it's backstage. I don't know if it's political. I don't know if it's just part of how he works as a performer and the ways that he can put someone over versus someone else who can maybe put people over into that level a little better. But Orton is not the guy to do that for whatever reason.
It's interesting because, you know, you think about the two biggest stars of the last 10 years, and it's obviously Cena and Orton, and a lot of the knock is always that they can't put guys over to get them to the next level. You know, there are a few exceptions. I think Daniel Bryan would be one. Maybe Punk is another, although you could argue Punk got over on his own. But, yeah, a lot of guys seem to eventually come up against Cena and Orton. And
both of those guys pretty solidly put over by Cena.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Punk on many occasions.
Yeah, and that's something to think about, whether, you know, I don't feel like Orton has, you know, a Triple H 2000-esque reputation as being this guy who just, you know, destroys people, but, well, maybe he should. I don't know. Because I feel like it almost feels like he doesn't do it as intentionally, but yeah. JD, check in on this one, man.
You know, it's interesting. I think, to go back to something that Glenn said that made me think about Jeff Hardy, too. You said Jeff Hardy came out of it looking okay, but he was also around for a good 10 years by that point.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, so he'd had quite a lengthy stay. As far as if Kofi could be sustainable, I'm inclined to say no, but that's after watching the last 5 years of him flounder. I don't know, though. You know what I mean? Like, I just look at 5 years of him being treated as insignificant and think, well, he was always going to be insignificant. But you watch this show and you watch that crowd and they really, really dug him, at least on that night and then at Madison Square Garden. If you can win over Madison Square Garden, that's saying something. My thought is this, whether it was sustainable or not, even if you can get 3 to 6 months out of it, why don't you take the 3 to 6 months you can get?
Absolutely.
You know, that's why I've always thought it was odd that type of mindset that says, well, this guy can't be a main event player. If the fans treat him like a main eventer, then latch onto that and ride it for as long as he can is my thought process. I don't know. I thought he really held his own here. I think maybe to be sustainable, he would have to kind of change some things around. I think a lot of his offense is very, what's the word for it? Like, almost like cartoony and not in a good way, you know.
It's not
like,
grounded.
Right, exactly. Like a monkey flip's fine, but just how he does some things. And it lends itself to be sloppy.
He does have that controlled frenzy, though.
Yes. Yes, he does.
And I will say, I know we're going to talk about the commentary in a whole later, but Matt Stryker calling Michael Cole out and asking him to explain what controlled
what's that
frenzy
mean?
Is. And Michael Cole saying it's frenzy that's controlled.
Yeah.
I do actually have a second Michael Cole note for this match. As people are entering, he calls CM Punk the Elliot Ness of SmackDown.
Yes. Yes.
And I wanted someone to ask him just what the hell he meant by that.
And you know what else is funny, Glenn, is I have all the WWE 2K and the Raw vs. SmackDowns from the few years. That line is in every Raw vs. SmackDown and 2K
seriously?
Game for the last 5 years. Is wow. Either Cole or Lawler calling CM Punk the Elliot Ness of WWE.
He's a teetotaler.
Right, exactly.
Is he looking to take down Ted DiBiase Jr. for tax fraud?
I would hope so.
Ted DiBiase, but the whole DiBiase posse.
Yeah.
They're all going down.
All right, before we go too far astray here, Steve, lead us into our break here with your thoughts on Kofi Kingston, on Randy Orton, on this whole landscape.
Kofi Kingston, I think,
would have had the ability to last a good 3 to 6 months, like Jordan said, like a good 6 months. And, you know, as you guys know, I work a lot with kids and adolescents. And when I hear that someone likes wrestling, I usually ask them, oh, who are your favorite guys? And mm-hmm. three names generally come up: Cena, Ray, and Kofi Kingston.
Oh,
and I think that he could have been a guy who could have driven a lot of merch, because, you know, people who are buying merch are either Scott Criscolo or parents for kids.
Yeah, and Scott can't help himself, so he would have bought it either. No. Anyways.
Right, yeah.
We love you, Scott.
If you put Kofi in Evolution, he would have bought the shirt.
That would be a controlled frenzy. Yeah.
Yes, it would. And I thought he was going to get a good push out of the, was it the Saturday Morning Slam that was out a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Like, I think he and Ziggler were kind of, you know, the faces of that. He's someone who would appeal to a lot of younger viewers with that cartoony style. That's why Rey's so popular. That's why Sin Cara, they pushed him for so long. And I think Kalisto is going to be the guy in the future.
Absolutely.
And we'll see what happens with him, with Kofi coming up too in present day, with, you know, being involved in this new gimmick of the New Day, and see how that's going to be face, or I think it's going to be heel.
All right. Well, that's something we'll probably talk about on the main event, or you guys will, because I'm not going to be on for like the next 2 months, but I know you guys will get to it. But as far as this show, we are 4 matches in. To 7. We have 2 big triple threat matches, and then a match I really want to pick Jordan's brain about. So, a lot of good stuff to discuss.
I think I know
up
what match that is.
A lot of good stuff coming up in the second part, but Glenn, Steve, Jordan, thank you guys so far. This has been a lot of fun. Guys, we are going to cut to what else you can listen to around the Place to Be Nation universe, and then we'll be back, as someone just slammed the door on this first part of the podcast. We'll be back in a moment.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling, we talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials one and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on PlaceToBeNation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcasts? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for the show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pav. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week, join Marcus Vandenberg and myself for the world's most dangerous sports show and the program that's changing the game one show at a time, the Kings of Sport Podcast. Available exclusively on PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the big four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
Welcome back, guys. We are here discussing the monolith of a show that is Survivor Series 2009 for the Place to Be Nation Survivor Series Rewind Series. I'm Ben Morse. With me is Glenn Butler, Steve Willey, and Jordan Duncan. We are four matches in. We have talked about everything from missed opportunities to white guys to Kofi Kingston, and now we got a little more to talk about. The second half of this show is definitely different from the first. We had our two, I said four matches in because that's because I'm looking at the Wikipedia page and I counted the dark match. If you guys are curious, Santino Marella defeated Chavo Guerrero on this night. Match time unknown, but that was the fourth match. But no, we're halfway through the main pay-per-view. At this point, halfway through, Steve and Jordan both said something interesting as we were off the air. If the show stopped here, you had the two Survivor matches and Batista Mysterio, which granted would be a short show, but where would you put it in the pantheon of Survivor Series, Steve?
I would put it very high up there. I think all three matches were above average. I really enjoyed the card so far. So I was, I heard a little bit of, I wouldn't say drama, but some downplaying of this overall card, and I was wondering where it was coming from.
Well, we will find out. Jordan.
Yes.
Pulling out snowflakes. Where you put the first half of this card?
I'm trying to channel my inner Chad Campbell here.
It'd be hard.
I would say probably 4 out of 5. Yep. It's really good, like Steve said. And even the Batista match is really just a squash, but it was more story than match, and the story was great.
It's a fun squash, though. How many sub-7-minute squashes can you say you enjoy as much as that Batista Mysterio?
Right, exactly, yeah.
Glenn, do you think that those three matches, good as they are, tend to get forgotten because of the era of WWE they were in, because of the second half of the show? Why do you think we don't talk about them as much?
I think a lot of shows and a lot of matches from this era, and really the whole Cena era, tend to get smushed together.
Mm-hmm.
By the sense that the roster is all the same, and we're seeing we're seeing a lot of the churn that tends to happen in the undercard, while maybe people think up top it's a little stale. Some people's impressions, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but a lot of these shows tend to be the victim of that. WrestleMania, not as much, because it's WrestleMania,
right,
and those tend to stand out in the memory more, but just considering these first few matches, I think it's a solid show. I think it would be a solid short show. The first match might be a little harder to judge at the time as opposed to now, when we can see it as really the building blocks for Sheamus and for The Miz, when it might have seemed a little random at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or a little disappointing, maybe.
Yeah.
But that benefits more from history. The matches yet to come might not benefit as much from history, but we'll see about that.
Well, let's get right into it. The next match is one of the two main events of the evening, and it's a triple threat match. It's for the World Heavyweight Championship, so that means it is centered over on SmackDown. And what you have is The Undertaker, who at this point was still more or less a full-time performer, was still taking his months-long breaks, usually after WrestleMania, but as far as summer, fall, winter, he was all in. He's the champ. And he's defending against the unified tag team champions of Chris Jericho and The Big Show, affectionately known as Jericho. The way this match had come about was at Bragging Rights the month before. It was Team Raw against Team SmackDown. Big Show was on Team Raw, but he helped SmackDown win in return for being promised a title shot at The Undertaker. But then his tag team partner, Chris Jericho, got involved, and they both ended up being named number one contender. So you have this match. Three guys going at it for the world title. Two of them are tag team partners. There had been some tension teased between them. Jericho had hit a code breaker going into this match. But it runs about 13 minutes, a little over. Goes back and forth all over the place. And ultimately, Undertaker ends up winning the match by submission, getting Big Show to tap to Hell's Gate. I want to get you guys' impressions, but I am going to say right off the bat that going back and watching this match, I actually enjoyed it. I thought, and it's the less heralded triple threat match on this show, but for a match where the outcome seemed more or less predetermined because you didn't think one of the tag champs was going to also hold the belt, particularly at this era where it definitely didn't feel like Jericho or Big Show was a legitimate threat to The Undertaker, I thought it was a fun match just in terms of the storytelling that Jericho and Big Show did. Of their relationship of, you know, can these guys work together? Do they hate each other? Will they be able to stay tag champs after the show? I thought they had a lot of fun. And I also liked that it was not so much the typical triple threat match in WWE where you'll see, you know, one guy go to the floor and you're basically just seeing a one-on-one match. These guys did, for the most part, Big Show was out a little bit, but the most part, I think the three of them stayed in the ring. And I think they played to the fact that you had three very different workers. As far as Jericho being the technician, Undertaker being the striker, and Big Show just being the monster. So I enjoyed this match, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think. Jordan, what did you think of the match? Did the fact that it seemed like Undertaker, I mean, it's hard to judge because we watched this 5 years after the fact, but did the fact that the outcome seemed pretty obvious, do you think that hurt it, or were they able to overcome it?
No, I think they overcame it pretty well, especially there was a spot where Undertaker went up for the last ride, and Jericho hit him with the belt, and that was really believable. It would have been a believable finish there. So, and like I said, this is all fuzzy to me. I assumed Undertaker won, but I couldn't remember if maybe he lost and won it right back or anything. So I wasn't 100% sure of the outcome of the match going in. So I think I did Jericho more so than Big Show was believable to me as being able to win. And honestly, that. To me, not to rag on the guy, but my initial reaction to watching this was when Big Show came out. I said, "Wow, he looks bad."
This is not Big
Show
his best.
2014 Big Show looks way better than 2009 Big Show, which is good for him, you know. So,
yeah, it was interesting. The thing is that watching, like, even as I was watching in 2009, I do remember Jericho being like a standout, like during a time where you don't remember a lot. Like they were over. They were legitimate, like, main event tag team. And they threw themselves into it. And I also think that was part of what hurt this match almost, because they were such – they did not feel like two singles.
They were a unit, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it felt like they're not going to break up right now. If they hadn't had the belts, I think the result would have been a little more in question. But they were definitely, they were over and they were doing well. But I forgot. It was weird because this was only a year past Big Show coming back and having lost all that weight. Mm-hmm. And like you said, today he looks better. I don't think the weird blue and black tights and the kind of King Kong Bundy shaved head look didn't help.
The knee brace looked like it was like cutting off circulation to his leg. It was not a good look for him. So,
Steve, what did you think of this match?
The word that stuck out to me that popped in my mind was pedestrian. Like there's a lot of it wasn't bad.
Yep.
It wasn't great. It wasn't a huge standout. And there's a lot of kind of typical spots that they would do, like on Raw, like Big Show kind of launch Taker into the post outside the ring, like he's gonna kind of give him the lawn dart, like I talked about before. Undertaker slides over the back and posts Big Show. Like you see that in almost every single match that he does. I like the beginning with Jericho working together. The kind of the two heels beating down Undertaker. I did think the finish kind of came out of nowhere, which I was kind of surprised at. Mm-hmm. I thought Undertaker was going to win. As I said before, I'm not really wasn't watching at this time period. So, but you can just kind of tell, especially with the number of belts that Jericho and Big Show were having. They didn't foresee them having three belts around like they were.
Hey man, Ultimo Dragon had like nine.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking of.
You know, it's doable. You know, as an aside, before we get to Steve, do you have more?
That was the main part. And then my favorite part of the match was, and I was surprised Lawler mentioned it after it happened, was Jericho taunting the fan who was telling him to go back to Toronto.
Yeah, I'm from Winnipeg.
I remembered that, and I didn't remember it was from this match, but I remembered that moment. I remember him yelling at someone, "I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot."
Yes, it was great, and he didn't even break like his stride. He was throwing, I don't remember who he was throwing into the ring, but as he was throwing it in the ring, it's just talked.
Well, it had to be Undertaker, because if he was throwing Big Show in, he would have broken his stride.
Yes.
As an aside, before we hear Glenn's thoughts, there are some, this is working in comics, this is something I'm aware of, there are some things that like you read or you don't say them a lot that like they're words that when you say them out loud enough back to back, you realize how ridiculous they sound, but they never did to you before. Like the example we always use is that Magneto sounds really dumb when we say it out loud, but on the page it's fine. But then when we say it out loud, I'm like, oh wow, that really is it's kind of a stupid name.
Is that why they always call him Eric?
Yes. That's why the movies avoid calling him Magneto at all costs. But Jericho may be a great example of that. They never said it a lot on the air. They were always just, you know, the team. But we always called them that on the internet. But now that I've said it, you know, at least a half dozen times in the last few minutes, Jericho is a really silly word. Glenn, what did you think about this match?
I think Jericho is a very silly word as well, but I like silly words.
I love Jericho. I love the word.
I like Jericho. I like Mizorison.
Yeah. Then the next year when Miz and Show were a team, they were Show-Miz.
Show-Miz, yeah.
That was they were big on that around this time.
For a 2009 show, this is a hell of a nostalgia hit. Guys, do you remember The Undertaker?
Yeah, right.
Do you remember when he like had matches and stuff?
Yeah. Wasn't a special attraction. He was just there.
He was there and he was champion and he was there every week.
He wasn't even he was a mid-carder on this show.
Yeah. I liked the control segments that Jericho had. They beat up on Undertaker together for a long time, and when you can compare that to the other triple threat match when we get there, but I think it makes an interesting comparison and an interesting choice. There was one point that they get to in every match where you have two guys who do the chokeslam, where they both grasp each other's throats, and just once in my life as a wrestling fan, I want to see that develop into a double choke slam.
Somehow, yeah.
They do the double big boot. There are other things they can do just once. I want to see him do that double choke into a double choke slam. I don't know how it would happen in terms of physics. I don't know what it would look like, but I want to.
You're so right, though. Anytime Big Show, Undertaker, and Kane, any combination of those three are in there, they will do that spot, and it will never pay off.
Yeah.
And I'm sure two guys on the indies have done it. I don't know how.
No. They wouldn't have done a double choke slam. They would have done a double choke slam twist with a bridge.
Through broken glass.
And then kicked out at one.
Yeah. anyways, not a lot more to say about this match. I think that's the thing.
I have one more thing to say about this match.
Jordan has more to say about this match.
There was an awesome line in the commentary where Stryker was talking about The Undertaker, and he goes, you know, the line from The Usual Suspects, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he doesn't exist, and Michael Cole goes, well, he does. He's right there.
It was a notable line, both for the fact that Michael Cole said that and also for the fact that what the hell was Matt Stryker talking
exactly
about? How did The Undertaker convince the world that he didn't exist?
Just said, do you guys remember him? So maybe it's working now. Who knows?
It's true. We have a whole commentary segment to get to that we've been teasing throughout this whole show, so it certainly won't live up to the hype. But definitely a Matt Strykerism of, this line sounds cool, I'm going to say it whether it makes sense or not. But we will get there. What I was going to say is, with this match, it's a good match. It's a fun match. I didn't hate watching it. I probably wouldn't watch it again because, like Steve said, not only pedestrian in terms of not being good or bad, but also just very inconsequential to the history of any of these guys or to the title or anything like that. But a match that was not, first of all, JD, do we have anything backstage?
Yes, we saw Miz and Drew and Sheamus celebrating a little bit and talking about they are, you know, the next big thing, basically.
I remember thinking that was kind of, I mean, it's not random because obviously you want to speak to winners, but it's kind of weird that Kofi didn't get a segment later. I guess he got the segment before, but yeah, like you really felt Miz, Drew, and Sheamus. It could have been a kind of a cool faction, like Miz and
Stewart. It seemed like that's kind of what they had in mind. Yeah.
But of course Drew was on SmackDown, so you couldn't use that. It's weird to watch this now. I know we're not that far out of the brand split, but this was, I haven't really talked about that much, how Survivor Series, you did get to see cross-brand alliances that you wouldn't normally see. Mm-hmm. But
right after they had the cross-brand rivalries at Bragging Rights.
Right, yeah, that's true. I did always think it was weird that for the 2 years it existed, that Survivor Series was right after Bragging Rights, and they would immediately go back to faces versus heels, but, you know, wrestling. One match that certainly was not pedestrian, anything but, is the last 5-on-5 Survivor Series elimination match of the night, and it is the Divas match, where we have women's champion Michelle McCool. Is she the women's champion or the Divas champion? Jordan?
Yes.
Okay. So we have...
Did they have the Divas championship in 2009?
It's something I wanted to talk about. They did.
They kept talking about the women's title during the match. I don't know. I don't remember when they...
It was... Michelle McCool was the women's champion. She captained a team of her, Jillian Hall, Beth Phoenix, Alicia Fox, and then Layla. They were right on the verge of becoming Lay Cool here. And then on the other side, you had Mickey James was team captain, but Melina was the Divas champion. She comes out with the belt. Mm. And then they also had Kelly Kelly, Gail Kim, and Eve Torres. So, you know, we have a match here. It's a 10-minute-long match. It was fun. It was, again, just girls hitting their finishers, and we'll talk about it in a sec. But, yeah, the big thing to me was that even as of 2009, they still had or perceived to have the depth in the Divas division where they had two separate Divas titles, and each show had a Divas division, which was always interesting to me because it just never felt like that was an idea. But, yeah, there were a lot of girls in this match. If we run it down here, only
two.
Layla and Alicia Fox, the only ones who are still around 5 years later.
Which is, surprising when you looked at the first match and saw all the guys in the face team who are so talented are gone.
Right.
And I like Alicia Fox. I think she's been doing quite well over the last year, but, you know, to think that those two are the ones that are still around is kind of surprising to me.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, Divas don't have as long a shelf life.
Right.
So obviously for obvious reasons, they're not going to go as long into their career. But just to break down the eliminations real quick, Kelly Kelly gets Layla with her finisher, with the K2 right off the bat. Michelle McCool gets Gail Kim out of there, which I remember that jumped out to me because I remember this as being like, man, Gail Kim in WWE just never used well at all.
But she's so good on Impact. Good.
Even in this match, when she was in there for a minute, she stood out. I was like, this is someone they could have done something with, and they never did. And she's still she is still a active competitor in Impact and doing well. And she
I would argue, out of WWE and TNA, the best active diva type wrestler.
Absolutely. I didn't get no argument from me. I think Gail Kim is the best women's wrestler in the major leagues. We had that. We had Jillian Hall go out to Eve Torres after that. And then Beth Phoenix takes out both Eve and Kelly Kelly with glam slams. And this was notable just because, you know, Beth was so different from everyone else here. And, you know, one of the she was really, I feel like, after you move past kind of the Trish Lita era, Beth was that iconic diva that no matter how many times she lost in stupid ways to like Kelly Kelly roll-ups and whatever, you could always rebuild her. She was always credible. And of course, she gets pinned here by Mickie James with a crucifix. And then take out Alicia Fox. And then Melina takes out Michelle McCool to make Melina and Mickie James the survivors. We kind of covered what I want to talk about, was just the churn in the Divas division. But what did you guys think of this match? I mean, it was really there to wedge between the two main events. Not a bad match. Let's compare the Divas division of 2009 to the Divas division of 2014, where you had all these girls who seemed, I'm going to say 2009, they very much seemed interchangeable. And I'm going to stump that in 2014, they at least have defined characters and some decent wrestlers, as much as probably Gail Kim and maybe even Michelle McCool and Mickie James and Beth Phoenix are more talented in ring than a lot of the people we have today. I think the Divas division is probably in better shape. Glenn, what do you think? You haven't spoken on this yet.
I think that the women's division in WWE tends to have about two solid, talented wrestlers in it at any given time. Gail Kim, I never watched a whole lot in Impact. I know she's very well thought of. I only really saw her in her WWE run, so I can't speak to that. But at this time, they had Mickie James, who I always liked, and Beth Phoenix, who was great for the time that she was there. They could badly use both of them now. Mm-hmm. And now they have AJ, whom I just love, and who was I just thinking of that I've completely blanked on?
I'm assuming it's Paige.
Paige?
Yeah. No, not Paige. Natalia.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Natalia, who's another solid worker in the division, and a bunch of other people who kind of come in and out and might turn in a good performance every now and then. But they only really have that core at any given time. And those are the people who stick in my mind, at least in terms of wrestling. And again, for their core back in 09, I really rather miss them. Now you mentioned Michelle McCool in the same breath. I never thought much of her as a wrestler.
I know a lot of people didn't, but I always elevate her just because, as far as a diva who could play a heel and really pull it off and be hateable, and it's rare, because I feel like the heel divas tend to be, you know, they're, at this time it was the Monsters. Beth Phoenix is stronger than everyone. She's a heel. Or they have I always thought Michelle McCool, I give her credit for being a different kind of heel. Like, she was beautiful, but she could still pull off just being just a bitch.
I completely forgot about her doing the Styles Clash too.
Yeah,
she did it well too.
Yeah. It's an easy move to hurt people on. I don't think she's
right
with it. So
there was, while we're still on Michelle McCool, there was one more Michael Cole note. He said at one point when Alicia Fox was in the ring, Cole said, Michelle McCool is barking out orders. And what Michelle was saying at that point was, let's go, Alicia.
Oh, Michael Cole. Steve, I want to save the heavy hitter for last on this one. So, you know what? I want to continue on this kind of comparison because it's interesting what Glenn said. I actually think the Divas division's in better shape in 2014 than it was in 2009. And I would say it goes beyond AJ and Natalya. I think, you know, Paige is in the mix. I think Naomi's very talented. And then you have the kind of next level of NXT. And I'll always say that I think the Bellas are better workers than they were and better workers we give them credit for. But where do you fall? Where do you think's kind of – where's the golden age of post-Fabulous Moolah women's wrestling in WWE?
Oof. Jeez. That is a load. I'm going to just take the easier route and just say now.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to make a list. You said Naomi, who I think is fairly underrated. I think she's pretty athletic.
Right.
If we are allowed to count NXT, I think Charlotte has a lot of potential.
Yep.
I think Sasha Banks is fantastic. She's a great natural heel, and I think Bayley's a really fun character.
I think Alexa Bliss is better than a lot of people give her credit to.
Once I just haven't seen enough of her.
Yeah, once I give her a chance.
Only been a couple matches. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I mentioned Alicia Fox is better now. She has an actual character. And
2009 Natalya. Alicia Fox versus 2014 Alicia Fox. Who wins?
Yes, 2014 Alicia Fox wins. She shakes up Mountain Dew.
The dream match to end all dream matches. Yeah.
That is Cameron of the Funkadactyls' dream match to end all dream matches.
It would be like Batista versus Rey from earlier on. She would give 2009 Alicia Fox three Turtle backbreakers in a row, dump a can of Mountain Dew on her, and that would be it.
I was going to say it'd be more like Batista versus Mason Ryan. But
yeah, I think now is, you know, as much as we laugh about it, you know, the Divas division when we're doing main event, it's still a lot better than it used to be.
Yeah.
And then the Attitude era had a bit, but there's only, you know, on one hand you can count the number of people who are competing at that moment.
Absolutely. All right, Jordan, give me your full detailed analytical breakdown of this 5-on-5 Divas elimination match.
Well, my initial thought was 5-on-5, why not 25-on-25? Let's get them all in here and still have it go 10 minutes. No. the thing that struck me was, wow, how long has Alicia Fox been around for?
I know. That kind of
got
me.
Like, and I actually was looking it up while Steve and Glenn were talking. She debuted in 2008.
Yeah. Well, she broke up Edge and Vicky's marriage.
Yeah. Man, that is crazy that she's been there that long. Just to talk about why the current division is in better shape, to kind of go with what a few of you guys said, especially Glenn, there are always those couple of girls who seem to know what they're doing compared to the other ones, you know? And I think, especially here in 2009, the ones they would kind of give the pushes to were never really those girls. Yeah. Kelly was supposed to be the star of the Divas division for a while. Even Melina, I never thought she was acrobatic and flexible, I guess, but she was never really good. Whereas now,
Bret Hart once called her the best wrestler in the world.
Yeah, right. So, you know, she does that Matrix thing and stuff like that. But you compare that to now, and the ones that are pretty good are the ones that they give attention to. And I think that's why it makes the division look better. AJ Lee is one of the better ones, the better workers, and Paige. And those are the ones that get the push. You know, Alicia Fox is the one who just throws Mountain Dew everywhere. I feel like I'm just ruining my gimmick here saying anything good. But yeah, I would take
dream come true.
Yeah, I would take the Bellas over Jillian Hall, over, you know, Kelly, Eve, you know. But this is what it was. I mean, it's an extended bathroom break. 10 minutes, honestly, is surprisingly long for what I expected this to be. I thought a 5-on-5 elimination match here, I thought they could really fit it into 4 minutes given what they were used to doing. I'm surprised it even went this long, to be honest.
Although even here, they continued the trend of there weren't a lot of transition roll-up eliminations. It is still mostly finishers. So
Yeah, like Beth Phoenix's and stuff. Here's my question. Were we into the quote, Piggy James era yet?
We were just on. Yeah, we had just
starting to it.
Yep.
Yeah,
they actually refer to it in the match a couple times.
Yeah. So, not a fan of that.
Yeah, I don't know who was, aside from Michael Cole, probably. I don't know why I'm bagging on Michael Cole. He seems like a great guy. He's a war correspondent.
I was watching the show on the network, and my son was saying, "Dad, why are you watching this?" I said, "I have to. Ben Morse is making me watch this, son."
Because it was part of an elaborate long con to get you to speak glowingly about the 2014 Divas Division. Now that I've accomplished that, really, we don't need to cover the main event.
Now that we've got this bit of audio in the vaults.
Yeah. That was the only part of the
show. Over Jordan's head.
Yeah. Jordan, this is the only part of the show we recorded. Everything else we've just been talking. You know, it's interesting you say how long Alicia Fox has been along, but for some reason, it does not surprise me at all that Layla is still there. Feels like Layla's always been there.
Layla's the last one left who came from the Diva Search, isn't she?
Yeah.
I don't even know if they know she's there. She just pops up on TV every once in a while.
It feels like Layla has always been there and always will be there.
Yeah.
And if really Layla's smart. If Layla's not there, I think something will feel off.
Layla was actually at WrestleMania 1.
Layla is constant as the Northern Star.
There it is.
Yes.
That is our tagline for this show. All right, so one match left.
I'm sorry, Ben. One note: now that we finished the last elimination match out of the three actual Survivor Series matches, I just wanted to note that if we were having the ultimate match of Ultimate Survival,
that match
would pit Mickey James, Melina, and Kofi Kingston against The Miz, Sheamus, and Drew. That would
be a great match.
Which is a hell of a confluence that they have three faces and three heels surviving.
It's an interesting dynamic also because, as we all know, Drew McIntyre does not have a good record against Divas. So it would be a more even match than we think.
Maybe they'd eliminate him by tying his hair to the ropes.
Probably. I am so glad that you brought that up, Glenn. I'm so glad that you tracked that. And someday we should just do some sort of feature podcast on something on what would be all the ultimate match of survival matchups.
That'd be awesome.
Through the
fantasy book them.
Fantasy book them. That's another show in itself. That's awesome. Thanks for bringing that up. So the main event. Another triple threat match, this time with WWE Championship on the line. John Cena defending against Triple H and Shawn Michaels, the two members of DX. And I think for most people, this is the match that makes or breaks this show. I know it was for Brad, who talked about it a lot when we were ranking it. He just did a great article on it on Place to Be Nation. It's interesting because you got all this stuff going on. You got all these guys who could be pushed. You have this great undercard feud in Mysterio versus Batista. You have Kofi, you have Randy, and at the end of the show, it really is, again, it's John Cena and DX on top. There's two schools of thought on this match. Again, it's another match where everyone kind of assumed, all right, one of the DX guys is not going to win. John Cena is obviously going to win here. And this was during a time where it wasn't a foregone conclusion that John Cena would win every month. He did lose the title frequently at this time. In fact, he lost it to Sheamus the next month. But the thought of this one is either you love this match because there's a few great moments. It goes 21-13, so it actually goes – it's the longest match on the show. It goes longer than any of the elimination matches between these three guys. And you either love the match because there's some unexpected moments, particularly right at the beginning, Shawn Michaels' Sweet Chin Music's Triple H out of nowhere.
Yeah, very cool.
And that's the one everyone remembers. And there's some cool spots throughout. Or you take the tact that this is probably the most formulaic triple threat match, WWE triple threat match particularly, that you're going to get, where it's never or rarely all three guys in the ring. It really is three separate matches of Cena versus Triple H, Cena versus Michaels, and Triple H versus Michaels, and the third guy has always been incapacitated for much longer than seems realistic. In the end, John Cena wins. He does it's kind of a cool finishing sequence where Michaels super kicks Triple H, and then Cena ends up, I think, he attitude adjustments Michaels onto Triple H, gets the pin. A lot of finishers, a lot of false finishes here going out. I had fond memories of this match, and I remember ranking it highly on that. I think because this was a match that slyly by these three guys was designed so that you remember the big spots, You remember that surprise super kick. You remember the double attitude adjustment. You remember that stuff, and you don't remember how kind of long the segments in between were. And, you know, Shawn Michaels is my favorite wrestler of all time, and I'll watch him in any match. But even here, I was kind of like watching him try to struggle on the floor, or watching Triple H be knocked out from a Sweet Chin Music for 15 minutes at the beginning, but then get up at a two count when he gets super kicked again later. Kind of strained the credibility of this for me. So splitting the difference, I don't think it was a terrible match, but it wasn't the classic I remember. I want to hear from everyone, thoughts on the match, and then we'll talk kind of about how this being the longest match and final match of the show ultimately affects our view of the show itself. Steve, why don't you kick us off talking about this match itself, your thoughts on watching it?
Well, in terms of the quality of the match itself, I think you did a great job of explaining it. The opening moments where the announcers were really hammering home the fact that, you know, how is this going to work? How are Shawn and, you know, how is Cena stand a chance? Shawn and HBK are going to work, or Shawn and Triple H are going to work together. I thought, man, you're kind of telegraphing the finish. You know, they're going to be fighting at the end. Mm-hmm. And then, boom, Shawn Michaels nails it. And Cena didn't actually overact here, you know, as he sometimes does with his facial mannerisms. He, you know, sort of like, oh, this is going to be a lot more difficult than I thought, a lot more surprising than I thought it would be. The thing I really did not like about the beginning of this match is, as someone who was not watching at the time, I had no idea why these guys were fighting and why this match was happening. I think that the other matches, they did an excellent job. You know, Divas match notwithstanding, but like they explained even in the match what was going on previously with Undertaker and Jericho and Big Show. They really hammered it home on the two Survivor Series matches, more about, you know, the feud between Miz and Morrison, the feud between Kofi and Randy Orton. This, they just like, okay, DX is together and they're going against Cena. Why?
I was trying to think back just now who was the GM of Raw at the time, see if that would explain it. And I think this was during the guest star era.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it even more nebulous. I don't even know who set this match up. And you're right, you know, they didn't say.
And some of the other matches, you know, the Survivor matches, they would talk about, you know, things that the wrestlers were going through during commentary, but they didn't during this match. It didn't say what the, you know, besides, you know, oh my gosh, HBK and Triple H are fighting.
Right.
Kind of other notes I had is, you know, for the first, I'd say about 15 minutes, there wasn't even an attempt to have a triple threat match.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a one-on-one match. And DX just, when they came out, looked like a bunch of buffoons.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, 40-year-old men with glow sticks. I paused it because I did not understand what HBK was wearing.
Yeah.
He had, you know, the fluorescent green armbands, one of which was around his thigh, like he was, you know, at junior prom. And he had, they were red, green, and white camouflage chaps that looked like cows. It was like a cow print more than camouflage. It's so bizarre.
The few people in wrestling history have looked less cool than 2009 era DX.
Yeah,
absolutely agree. Steve, I think you're making a great point about the lack of kind of explanation on this match. And I think a lot of that came back to kind of, whereas everything else on the show is very story-driven and very character-driven, this match literally was, these guys are A-list, main event, Hall of Fame guys. If we put them in a ring together, that's going to sell the pay-per-view.
Right.
And we don't need to have a reason. They just need to fight. And I think that's ultimately what does doom the match, is that there is really no storyline. Because unlike with Jericho, where they're heels and you really don't know where it's going to go, there wasn't a lot of thought that in 2009, Triple H or Shawn Michaels was going to turn on the other. You know, maybe 3 years earlier, maybe earlier than that. Sure, you could see Triple H going heel. But in this match, they were, it goes back to the way you said, the way they came out, they were so family friendly and so shilly at this point that it was like they were basically, you know, they were the 2009 equivalent of WCW Public Enemy, where they would do those spots in the back for the merchandise. But yeah, a lot of good points, man. Glenn, what did you think of this match?
I think there's an interesting comparison to draw between the two triple threat matches on this show. When you're doing a triple threat match with people who are in a tag team, there are two things you can do. You can either have them work together or you can have them turn on each other. Or, you know, they're not going to work together for the whole match, but the sudden but inevitable betrayal can be delayed. And having them both on this show gave them an opportunity to do both. The announcers, like Steve said, were blathering on about, will there be an implosion eventually between Triple H and Shawn Michaels? And then, boom, immediately it happens, and we're off to the races. Whereas in the world title triple threat, Jericho both beat on The Undertaker together for a good amount of time. So I think that was an interesting way to do it, to kind of react to expectations in a way that they don't always put in the thought to do. And having the long segments where it was one-on-one between pick two of the guys in the match is something that I can understand the criticism of, but I think it goes to that sort of way that they wanted to construct it. So I think it came off pretty well. It's not a classic. And in fact, other than that super kick at the beginning of the match, the thing that I really remember about it was that this was the night that John Cena debuted his New York Knicks colors. But also on a historical note, given that this was pretty soon before Shawn Michaels retired, is this the last Triple H Shawn Michaels match?
In terms of them fighting?
Yeah.
I think probably. Can't think of another time they went at it. Again, I'm sure someone will tell us if they did.
Maybe. But, if they had something on Raw or something.
Right. Unless they had a Raw match in the winter. Yeah, this would be the last time. So it's definitely a historic moment in that sense. Last time they go up against each other. Jordan, wrap it up as far as thoughts on the match.
There's not a lot to add, to be honest. I think Steve and Glenn both really described it well. We basically got three singles matches thrown in a blender. You know, that's the best way I can describe it. And what's good about it is, hey, Cena and Shawn, that sounds good.
Yep.
Cena and Triple H, that's not bad. Triple H and Shawn, we've seen that be good before. So in a vacuum, this was not bad at all. Forgettable? Yeah, probably. It almost feels like it was like a greatest hits CD. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, here's the cool stuff we do. Here's all the big spots. I mean, gosh, how many sweet chin musics did we see? At least three, maybe four. So in that sense, I imagine being there live, you would have been like, this match was phenomenal. That seems like a great match to see live.
Oh yeah.
In the arena, you know? But 5 years removed, I don't really remember it. You know, 5 hours removed, I remember the big spots, but I don't remember any of the stuff in between them so much. And that's not a knock on it. It's perfectly fine. But it is what it is, you know. I think the other guys said everything that needed to be said. I didn't hate it, but it's not something I would be clamoring to go back and watch anytime soon.
I think the one thing we all have in common with our take on this match is whether you like it, hate it, regardless, is that even if it's solid in ring, it's fairly forgettable. Mm-hmm. And I think that is kind of, you know, to kind of look at the bigger picture here, that's kind of the knock on this show and this era, is mm-hmm. that for all the good moments you had, you don't really remember it because there wasn't anything significant going on. And it's kind of sad because when I watched back on the show, I was like, they could have been onto something here and it could be propelling them to this time we're in now. There's so many guys who could have become stars here. And not all of that is the fault of WWE. Very little of it, actually. But I guess the main event kind of crystallizes it for me in that it's such a forgettable main event. And you wonder... We talked about how the first half of the show was pretty good. Like, Jordan, you said 4 out of 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
First triple threat, I thought was pretty solid as well. I think the Divas match is as good as, you know, a Divas elimination match is going to be without some sort of all-star roster. But again, this match being the longest match on the card and just being something that really did not feel, for as talented and as big name as the guys in the match were, really didn't feel like there were any stakes, even though it's for the biggest championship. If you have a better main event on top here, or if you have a more memorable main event, or if something huge had happened to the main event, does that bump this Survivor Series a little higher up in the rankings? And how much does this main event hurt the overall card? So where would you kind of place the card now that we're done all the way through? Steve, where do you put this on your overall Survivor Series list?
Now, I haven't seen all the Survivor Series, but I thought that there's not a bad match on the show. And mm-hmm. when I'm looking at a full card, that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at huge standout moments / matches, and the overall construction of the card is, are there any stinkers? Are there any times where you want to go away to the bathroom for a few minutes? Mm-hmm. And there really wasn't. Like you even said, even the Divas match was like, it was okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say that overall it's an above average show, which is good. You know, like, there's a lot in this era from what I understand that are not above average shows. And
right.
So all time, I would say definitely in the top half for sure.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think so many of us passed this era over that it almost makes me want to go back and watch other 2009 shows and be like, were they? Maybe they weren't that bad. Maybe it's just, you know, no one was watching and no one cared.
But that's a note I had during the Batista-Ray match. Mm-hmm. I was wondering how this was received at the time since I wasn't watching.
Right.
And I'm just kind of wondering, compared to today, do we underrate the current stuff as it's going on?
Right.
Because we're wrapped up in the day-to-day. Like, you know, we rip on the product a lot, you know, in the main event lately. But overall, you know, match-wise, we got some great stuff. So
yeah.
Will this be a time that we look back upon more fondly as we – you know, with the network now being able to go back and watch some of this again pretty easily,
yeah,
will we rewrite history kind of? And I'm willing to bet that we will do the same 5 years from now with this era of wrestling as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting just that at the time, I definitely, as a fan, and I think you guys the same, because you were either casual fans or just not that tuned in, I definitely wasn't the type who, you know, was discussing the product at the length I do today, where we have podcasts that were on, or even I remember this was the time when Scott Keith was kind of on hiatus, and, you know, he was the guy I would read on this type of thing. So I really, when you asked Steve, like, you know, how did people receive the show? I don't even know. Right. I wasn't tuned in enough. I all I knew was that the people in Washington D.C. seemed to cheer a lot. So I guess, Jordan, where do you put this on the all time Survivor Series list, or is it kind of a hard to judge?
Where would I put it right now, or with your original question, if there was a different ending in the main event or a different main event altogether?
Where do you put it with this main event? And if you take that main event off and maybe get something better, how much does it move up or down?
Gosh, that's hard to rank. I'm only halfway through your guys' show where you guys are ranking them. My gut reaction is in the middle of the pack somewhere.
Right.
Because that's just kind of what it feels like. This is a middle of the road show. You know, it's, starts off pretty good. By the end, you're like, eh, that's all right, you know. I think with a different finish to the main event, and I don't know what the finish could have been.
Right.
Because, you know, a Triple H title win isn't exactly revolutionary or anything like that. I think it would have bumped it up, maybe just because a title change, you know, may make it more memorable.
This was during a time where they were changing the title every month, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had just switched it between Cena and Orton.
Cena had just won it for months, right? Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah.
I don't know. And I think to go to what Steve said, too, you know, how he says, you know, 5 years down the road, we may look back at our current product now. I think, you know, the stuff we're watching now, we look at through the lens of storylines and payoffs and things like that. Whereas we watch this stuff now, 5 years removed, we just want to see if it was a good match or not.
Right.
Sure.
So I don't really know what the storylines were there. And I do know that the storyline payoff to Kofi Kingston and Randy Orton was not good. Yes. But on this night it was.
Yes.
You know, and that made the match better, you know. So, yeah, just looking at it without knowing a whole lot about the storylines. And somebody already mentioned earlier, they did a real good job throughout the show of helping me remember what the storylines were. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew all about Batista and Rey thanks to the announcing and the video package and stuff like that. I think this match that we just talked about suffers a little bit. Maybe not so much that they couldn't tell the story. I don't think there was a whole lot of story there other than, hey, look at these three guys fighting. And that kind of was the story, you know, as I remember it. So, but I think, I think that would be kind of a cool project. If you go back through like 2008, 2009, that stuff we kind of write off as, that wasn't very good. Maybe it wasn't good because it didn't have good, satisfying conclusions to stories and things like that. But the matches themselves, I can't point to anything on this show and say, oh, this was awful, because none of it was. It was all good.
I agree. Before we talk a little bit about the announcing the overall presentation, Glenn, overall show, just as far as kind of in-ring product and storylines and whatnot, what was your overall impression and how much did the main event matter?
I was just laughing listening to Jordan talk about not remembering the storyline behind the main event. Yes, because as I recall, a lot of the build-up to the main event involved skits between DX and Hornswoggle.
Oh, yeah.
You're which right. Steve and Jordan know has been a favorite of mine. I think one of the most consistently entertaining people in the company for years and years, who does not get his due sometimes. So I frankly expected you guys to remember more of that, and I expected to be called on the carpet to defend that. So that just seemed highly amusing to me. But this was when they did Little People's Court. This is the whole world under the ring.
Oh,
this
wow.
this
okay.
was a lot of that stuff between DX and Hornswoggle, and then they kind of involved John Cena in it, and it turned into a title match. but I don't think hurts the show. It doesn't. A great main event can elevate a show, but this main event doesn't hurt the show. Mm-hmm. I think a title change wouldn't have helped it at all because, like we were just saying, they changed the title so much during this time. He had just switched it between Cena and Orton month to month to month, practically. Mm-hmm. So,
literally. I think the last
yeah, before actually,
they did a change every month.
So that wasn't really something that would have bumped it up at all. I thought the main event was fine and had a few spots that were really good. And I think that would describe the second half of the show generally.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So
well,
in
nope, keep going.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say in terms of all Survivor Series, I would have no definite idea where to place it. I can see where there would be a debate about it, and I look forward to listening to your ranking of it, which I haven't yet.
Oh, just that one's an all-timer. That episode of the Brad and Chad Show is probably it's the best since the last time Steve Willey was on it.
There you go. Which was the previous show.
Yeah, it was the previous episode.
Me and Steve are gonna do a show where we rank the Brad and Chad shows. Actually,
won't be very long.
Well, it's the Ben and Glenn show.
The Ben and Glenn show makes a lot more sense to me. It smells like ratings. But all right, this is kind of an unorthodox way to end this. But now that we've talked about the entire in-ring show and storylines, we've been getting ready to talk about this show, I think I watched it first out of all of us because I watched it like last weekend. And immediately to me, I was like, one of the big things I want to talk about is the commentary and specifically Matt Stryker. And I was overjoyed when you guys, as we were prepping for this, were like, we have to talk about Stryker and the commentary. So that's actually going to be how we bring this rewind to a close is we're not going to talk about John Cena, Triple H, and Shawn Michaels. We're going to talk about Matt Stryker, Michael Cole, and Jerry Lawler because it was fascinating to me to listen to this, how different this show sounded than a show today. And I'm going to go right out there. I'm going to say both good and bad because Matt Stryker is a fascinating announcer to me. He is so all in. He is so enthusiastic, and it's both his greatest strength and his greatest weakness. And I know he's currently getting pretty good reviews on Lucha Underground. And I remember watching him when he was a commentator on ECW or when he was a commentator on SmackDown. I enjoyed him. He would be annoying sometimes with his tendency to nickname everybody, with his tendency to get really, really into it. But it was also kind of a nice change of pace, particularly from Michael Cole, who was so snarky and just seems so angry to see Matt Stryker, who is legitimately seemed thrilled to be watching and calling these shows. But at the same time, as I watched him on this, I was like, you know, I wonder how much of Stryker's deficiencies are him or the fact that it's who he's working with. Because it seemed like Lawler and Cole you could tell, and I felt like you could always tell, they did not want to be working with Matt Stryker.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They were
yes.
very open about it, and it felt like they went out of their way to kind of cut his legs out from under him, to make him look stupid, to make fun of his enthusiasm. And, yeah, again, Matt Stryker has a lot of flaws, but when he was working with, you know, say, a Josh Matthews or something like that, because Josh Matthews was kind of in the same boat, or like a Todd Grisham or anything like that, they would work to compliment him. They would try to rein him in, but they would do it in a way that wasn't, hey, you're an idiot. So I want to hear what you guys thought about Stryker, about the commentary, about everything. But I also, you know, I want to put that question out to you guys. Could Matt Stryker have been a great announcer if he had been paired with different people and he didn't have Cole just being so openly hostile towards him? Let's start start with Glenn, because I know you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah. Matt Stryker came in for a lot of criticism during this time, and he's come in for a lot of retrospective criticism since then. I always liked Stryker. I liked his enthusiasm. I always think that an announcer has to be really enthusiastic, or else we won't be enthusiastic. If we listen to someone who's just not interested in what's going on at all, or doesn't communicate that he's interested, then it's going to be that much more of a lift that the wrestlers and the other performers have to do to get us invested in what's going on. He had his tics, he had his nicknames, he had some of the insider terms he liked to throw in there, but I never thought that was a deal breaker for him. I think he was better on ECW. I think he was better even on SmackDown for some of the reasons you say, because Cole and Lawler seriously hated him and they undermined him at any opportunity. I definitely agree. But even despite all that, I always kind of liked him.
Yeah. It really highlighted to me a lot of the things that bother me now, that it feels like sometimes Cole and JBL in particular are more concerned about like getting jabs in at each other than they are about, you know, putting over the product. And to me here it was Stryker. He wasn't into that. He never took, he wasn't taking shots at Cole, but Cole was so into taking shots at him. Uh-huh. Steve, what do you think about the commentary on this show?
Well, I think what you're saying too, I'd also up Jerry Lawler's game, that he wasn't devolving into, you know, just bad jokes. Pretty much you would have to have a conversation going on.
Right.
I thought for the first few couple matches, I thought that he added something, whereas as the current crew that's going on actually detracts from the matches at times. In the first match, he really introduced the characters as they were coming to the ring for people who, and there are people who just watch the pay-per-views, or maybe they're, you know, just friends of people who are fans who are just hanging out for the pay-per-view. He introduced the motivation of each character. Cole does that sometimes today, but it's clear that he's reading off of a sheet when he's doing it. And so this is like, okay, here is Kofi Kingston, and here is his motivation for what he is doing. I also like that he does some of that insider stuff. He called MVP when he won with his kick, he called it a Chono kick, and I kind of like that stuff. The wrestling nerd in me likes that. But his, you know, he can go off into hyperbole quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that Usual Suspects line was kind of the crystallization of what is wrong with Matt Stryker.
Right, and I can only imagine what he was like as a teacher. He had to be, like, insufferable to have as a teacher.
He just seemed like the most over-caffeinated. Yeah. Jordan, final thoughts on the commentary.
You know, it was distracting. It's odd. I would notice a few times, I'm like, all right, Stryker needs to chill out with these nicknames. And then Cole would say something just purely spiteful, and you feel bad for the guy. Like, dude, shut up, man. You know, like, I kind of felt bad for him. Yeah. And you know what? You know why I think it's excusable to me is he seems to really enjoy what he's doing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the nicknames are ridiculous. I even wrote a bunch of them down.
please, like, hit us.
Please.
I got a couple, and I only started paying attention about halfway through, and I just want to see how, if you guys can figure out who he's talking about. Who was the blue-eyed bandit?
Oh, wow. Christian?
The blue-eyed bandit was Cody Rhodes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That one didn't... I don't know. That one didn't stick. The chef of Hell's Kitchen.
Mark Henry.
That's right. And
I remember that one because that's the sort of thing where sometimes these nicknames kind of defy fridge logic. Yeah. Where he says it and then it just kind of washes over you, and then after a second you think, wait, what?
Yeah, exactly.
Mark Henry is the chef of Hell's Kitchen. What the hell does that mean?
And Cole kind of responded in that way because he says the chef of Hell's Kitchen, and Michael Cole goes, or the world's strongest man. Like very, very defiantly, like, no, he's got a name, all right?
Such a dick.
How about this one? From the seaside town they forgot to shut down. That was William Regal from the seaside town they forgot to shut down.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
That's actually a great. He always had the best nicknames for Regal because he loved
I only got one more. He referred to one guy as Stonehenge-like.
No, Seamus, right?
That was Seamus. I thought it was interesting that it was not just a stone, Stonehenge.
Stonehenge, yeah.
And like.
Yeah.
Just like.
Yeah, exactly. So
there's something of flexibility. I can't remember what it was.
Oh yeah, Cole hated that one. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't know. I don't know if he was distracting or the fact that Cole responded to him so like almost viciously made it even more distracting. You know, and I just feel like the guy probably had his legs cut out from under him. I would love to hear about the political ramifications of Matt Stryker being moved up to the main roster and stuff. I would love to know that stuff, but I don't know.
Buy his shoot interview.
Yeah. He was on Cabana's podcast and he talked a lot about it. He was actually very humble about it though. He came out right and said he was like, there was a lot I didn't know what I was doing, and they took me to task for it and I learned a lot. I don't know. Seems like a cool guy. And I will say that to Steve's point, he went out of his way to keep Lawler engaged, which is something they don't do today. He would ask Lawler questions.
Well, there was a moment where it was in the Christian match, because Christian was in the ring, where he actually asked Jerry Lawler something like, am I annoying you, or should I shut up, or something like that.
He did.
But I don't know. I think it was a little annoying, a little over the top, but it comes through as a guy who really, really enjoys the product, and that's fine with me, you know? I may have to mute him here and there, but I'd rather hear that than the current product where they mock their own show.
Right.
You know, JBL buries stuff.
Yeah.
And not in a Jesse Ventura type way. Like, the bunny's the stupidest thing on television.
Yeah.
Great. You know, like,
so why am I watching it out?
Yeah.
You know,
I guess I should change the channel. Absolutely.
Exactly. So.
Well, guys, we did it. We got through Survivor Series 2009. When we started this journey, I think we made a little fun of the show we were reviewing, and I think we learned something along the way. We learned something about this era. We learned something about what makes a Survivor Series, and I like to think we learned a little bit about ourselves as well.
And love.
I thank each and every one of you guys. Guys, this was fun. Hopefully we'll get the band back together and review TLC 2009. Coming up very soon. It's a new concept pay-per-view, which they mentioned that a bunch of times. They said, we have a brand new concept. They're hyping TLC as the next show. But, yeah, we can get back together and watch Kofi Kingston's bright, shining push come down in flames. And there's no group I'd rather do it with. So, Glenn, Steve, Jordan, thank you for being part of this show. Everybody who listened just hit the download link, expecting this would be Scott and Justin. Thank you for hopefully sticking with us. You can, of course, find all of us on placetobenation.com. You can find Steve and Glenn with the High Spot. You can read Jordan's 24 articles if you go in the archives. And myself, Steve, and Jordan join Scott and Andrew Reich every other Wednesday on the main event. But we will bid you guys adieu. I don't know when this is coming out, so probably go vote in the 90s music tournament, I guess. Otherwise, enjoy whatever else is going on. Until next time we do this, this is Ben Morse for Glenn, for Steve, for Jordan, saying thanks for listening, and I don't know. I didn't come up with a sign-up line. Jordan, can you give me a Stryker nickname?
The best in sports while wearing jorts.
There you go. Talk to you guys soon. Shut up.